Brad Sesmat Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
It's the Brad Sesmat Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. Filling in for Brad today, I'm Jared Cohen. That's Greg Esposito. You can call him Espo. And we also host the Dry Heat Check podcast that you can check out each and every week on Sports 360 AZ and iTunes and Audio Boom and on Mars. There's a lot of places you can check that out.
Wherever you can get audio through your ear holes, you can get us.
That's absolutely right. We've got a great show set up for today. The World Series going on. The Cubs drop the first game. The Indians take a 1-0 series lead. We'll talk to Pedro Gomez, our ESPN baseball insider, who was in Cleveland and was there last night. And we'll also catch up with Paul Coro as the Suns kick off, or should say tip off.
There should.
As so much football talk the last, I don't know how many months. The Suns tip off their 2016-17 NBA season tonight as they host the Sacramento Kings, so we'll get into that. We'll do a little less Cardinals talk. We'll save that for tomorrow and Friday. We'll focus more in on the World Series and the Suns today. Starting with the World Series, though. So you and I are in a situation where we have tons of family that are diehard Chicago.
Let me make this clear. Not my family, my wife's family.
Oh, hopefully she's not listening right now. Because if I said that, that would have gotten a nice little stern look.
I'm sure I'll get a text in about 2 minutes that I'm sleeping on the couch this evening.
So people that you are associated with called family.
Correct.
And then my mother's side of the family, including her, diehard Chicago. In fact, for the first half of my life before the Diamondbacks were around, I was all about the Cubs. So it's a very exciting time for anyone who has any sort of Chicago affiliation or blood. And everyone's been dialed into all these games. Game one, kind of a disappointment if you're a Cubs fan. And it's also a product. That game, in a nutshell, 6-0 lost to the Indians. That game, in a nutshell, is what the Cleveland Indians have done all season. Pitching and opportunistic offense was exactly what the story was of last night's game, and it's been the story of their whole season.
Well, see, for me, what last night emphasized is how ridiculous it is that the winner of the All-Star game gets home field advantage.
That's true,
in the World Series. Because last night in Cleveland, it was a case of a team feeding off the energy of their home crowd. 37,000 people in that building, and it felt like 80,000 because it's such an emotional day in Cleveland as sports fans. Cavs raising the banner across the street, Indians in the World Series, and you just saw it. I mean, from word one, the Indians just fed off that energy. And to me, it's ridiculous that the Cubs, they won 103 games, best team in baseball.
11 more wins than the Indians had.
They have to start off in Cleveland and lose that momentum, because could you imagine what Wrigley would have been like?
It would have been
coming off of the NLCS win and then going straight into game one of the World Series. You lose a large advantage in that, and to me that was a large part of last night. Obviously not everything. The Indians played fantastic. Their pitching was about as good as any pitching that I've seen in a very long time from any club in a World Series.
And you mentioned what Wrigley would have been like. Look what it was like in Game 6 against the Dodgers.
Oh, yeah.
There were errors that were made. I can't remember who dropped it, but there was a fly ball in the first inning with Kershaw on the mound. Just a routine fly ball. I think it was to left field. And the guy just outright dropped it. Yeah. That's because Wrigley was putting the pressure on him. You knew he was thinking about it. Wrigley Field caused that error in the fans. Not anything that the player or the Cubs did, you know, that there was definitely something to that. The only thing that I look at the way this series is lined up, the Cubs are a very mentally tough team. You know, everyone's talking about the curse and the pressure, but this team just seems so oblivious and ignorant to the past. You saw that in the Giants series, the way they came back. You saw that against the Dodgers when they were down 2-1 and then kind of stomped in their throats in game 6. If you come out in game 2 and you win it with Jake Arrieta on the mound going up against Trevor Bauer, who has just been hasn't really changed much from a personality standpoint since he left here and gone to Cleveland. If you steal game 2, now you're looking at 3 consecutive games at Wrigley with a 1-1 series. I think that might actually help the Cubs' cause. But if they go down 0-2, they're going to find themselves in quite the hole.
Well, yeah, look, anytime you go on the road to start a series, your goal is to split those two games. It just is. If you win both, it's a bonus. But splitting them puts home field advantage back in your court, or in this case, on your field. no, I didn't mean it like that. But, you know, so I think you're right. If they come out, they win tonight, it doesn't really matter. But you can't tell me that Corey Kluber was going to go out at Wrigley Field and have that kind of a dominating performance when it doesn't have his home crowd behind him. If you look at it, when he started, I believe it was game five, or the second to last game of that Toronto series, he lost. I mean, he lost on the road in Toronto. It wasn't, I think he benefited from playing at home. It's interesting, you bring up Trevor Bauer, you look at it and you go, oh, there's another guy the Diamondbacks traded, and oh, now he's starting the second game of the World Series for the Cleveland Indians.
It's pretty amazing. I don't have as much ill will towards the loss of Trevor Bauer as I do with others, because his personality was, I think, what was the biggest issue, and his kind of stubbornness. He didn't pitch that great this year for the Indians. He's honestly their number three or four starter at best, but they've dealt with injuries to Carlos Carrasco and Danny Salazar, and he's kind of there by fault. He's not exactly there because he's been their legit number two or number three pitcher. They're down their two best starters. Salazar and Carrasco were actually 1 and 2, and Kluber was 3. And so you look at Bauer being in that position, I don't think it's exactly because, oh, look, there's another Diamondback that they screwed up on. It's more so because he is a guy that they're still trying to mold as a young guy to be talented and have a future. But it's a product of, we just need arms to get us through innings, to get us to the bullpen, which our bullpen is so great.
It's still a young guy that Diamondbacks let go. Before we move on from this topic, though, let's talk about the stones of Terry Francona, all right?
Bear down. Well,
this guy, yes, a U of A Wildcat. This guy comes in and in this entire playoffs has managed his pitching staff where he's relying on his bullpen to do things that most managers would never rely on their bullpen to do. Asking Andrew Miller to come in and pitch 2 innings and really carry, and really taking the chance of taking Kluber out because he was pitching so well he could have continued on, but Francona wants him for game 4, so he takes him out knowing Miller can go numerous innings. And it's a recipe for success that Francona has had throughout this playoffs, and it's something that most managers wouldn't have the intestinal fortitude to do. So I give him a lot of credit for the way that this Indians team's been playing.
Let's switch gears here. That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen. The Phoenix Suns, they open up their regular season here tonight. They go up against the Sacramento Kings in their home opener. It's always an exciting time, the promise of a new season. And to be honest, Espo, I feel like the demeanor around this team just feels different. It feels more optimistic. You know, the last few years, it's, oh, we're going to stink. We have to stink because of who's coming up in the draft. This year feels more like, we kind of have those young pieces now from who we've gotten in the draft. Now let's watch them grow and kind of root for them to grow with not as much of a focus on let's just suck so the draft gets here and we can draft someone else. Do you kind of get that vibe? Because it seemed like that the last few years where it's let's just suck this season and draft Ben Simmons, or let's just suck and draft Karl Anthony Towns. You know, this year it's
felt like those would have been great plans. Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
It didn't happen, but they drafted Devin Booker. They drafted Marquise Chris and Dragan Bender. They kind of have the pieces that you hope can be part of the next Suns team that can make a run into the playoffs. And it kind of has more of a feel, to me at least, that I don't need to focus as much on the draft now. I'm more dialed into the young guys that they have accumulated to watch them grow.
Look, I'm going to butcher an old sports quote because I don't have a great memory, but it goes something like this. Everybody's brave and confident until they get smacked in the mouth, all right? And you can give me all this fluff and this great talk and this pomp and circumstance and Earl Watson's love and you know, camaraderie and all that, but when they lose 9 out of 10, or they come out and they get blown out by 40 points, which this team is going to have happen this year with such a young roster, that's when does the vibe feel different. Because it's real easy for a first-year head coach to sound like he's got a great plan and to sound optimistic. It's great for Devin Booker to talk as if this is a playoff team, but none of that will matter unless it's around when the hard times come. And over the last 6 years, the Suns have folded in those kind of situations. When the situation got difficult, this team had locker room issues, had issues between their players and the coach. Now, a lot of those problems, Markieff Morris, are gone from this roster, but you still have to see how this team reacts. Because Earl Watson's message is great. And the rah-rah, you feel good about it when you hear it, but how does it play with these athletes and this team when they're having tough times? Because this is going to be an up-and-down season. Unless there is some miracle that happens this year and Devin Booker becomes an MVP candidate and Eric Bledsoe's an all-star and Brandon Knight is the sixth man of the year and Marquise Chris is the rookie of the year, this is going to be another lean year. It's going to be difficult. So I need to see it when times get hard.
Now, before we shift gears, we'll talk to Paul Coro in just a little bit. The veterans that have been brought in, there's not a lot of talk of them. Tyson Chandler's still here. PJ Tucker is still here when he comes back from injury. And they added Jared Dudley and Leandro Barbosa in the offseason. What kind of role do you see them playing over the course of the season? You mentioned Dudley already kind of in that stretch four role to start the season, might not be there for long.
Well, look, you bring up the fact that there's not a lot of talk about the veterans. And there shouldn't be, because these guys should get limited minutes when it comes down to it this year. They should be there to teach these guys how to be professionals and to show them the ways to play basketball right and to fill in as bench guys over time. I want to see youth this year. If we're seeing a lot of minutes for Jared Dudley, Leandro Barbosa, Tyson Chandler, the likes, it's not a success. They need to grow the youth this year.
That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen. Coming up next on the show, Pedro Gomez will switch gears back to the World Series as the Cubs have taken a 1-0 series deficit. I said that wrong. I meant to say Indians take a one lead, but we got through it. Greg Esposito, I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad. Pedro Gomez is next here on the show.
It's time to talk Arizona Diamondbacks and Major League Baseball with ESPN insider Pedro Gomez. Here's Brad Sesmat.
Jared Cohen and Greg Esposito filling in for Brad Sesmat here on the show. Always love being joined by Pedro Gomez. He joins us from Cleveland, where the Indians have taken a 1-0 World Series lead over the Chicago Cubs. And as we get started, Pedro, that's Greg, I'm Jared filling in for Brad. One of the biggest storylines of this game, too, I haven't seen mentioned that much, is there's a possibility that Trevor Bauer could be going up against Miguel Montero, who, didn't they openly not like each other when they were at the Diamondbacks, and then Trevor Bauer kind of dogged on him in a rap song shortly after? That hasn't really been talked about from what I've seen.
Yeah, you know, the story is that when Bauer got called up, remember, Bauer was a midseason call-up.
Yes.
And, you know, the starting catcher, Miguel Montero, comes over to him and says, hey, now that you're here, love to take you to dinner. You know, we can talk about whatever, catcher, pitcher, anything. And apparently Bauer's response was, you know, my family's in town. It's not really a good night. And Miguel said, oh, no, I understand. That's perfectly fine. And made two more attempts to take him out to dinner. And twice was rebuffed, and Montero at that point basically said, you know what, whatever. You know more than everybody, so, you know, we don't need to go out. And, you know, in talking to players, pitchers specifically from other teams, basically the response should have been, hey, Mom, Dad, I'll see you at 10 o'clock. I'm going to go out to dinner with, you know, the catcher. That's kind of what you have to do. And, you know, the thing with Bauer is he's always been, I'll use the word eccentric, but I'll tell you that the word odd, weird, there's been other words attached to him. So, yeah, it was not a good relationship. Listen, you did not trade away the number 3 overall pick that early in his career unless there's more going on.
I don't have any weird rap song questions or anything for you. Like, Jared, I just have one simple question that may be weird in and of itself. Is it bizarre that Cleveland is the epicenter of sports right now and you happen to be there?
I mean, yes. You know, the ring ceremony across the plaza last night at Quicken Arena, the Indians hosting Game 1 of the World Series. I will say this, the happiest front office in all of sports right now has got to be the Cleveland Browns. Because at 0-7, nobody is paying attention to the Browns, which is what they want. Because if the Indians had just had a so-so season and been done 3-4 weeks ago, the Browns would be getting hammered in every direction right now. And instead, they've had a free pass, and it'll be a free pass for half of the NFL season because the Indians have gone on this run.
It's Pedro Gomez joining us from Cleveland. And when I look at this Indians team, and you saw, you've seen them up close now, I'm sure a few times through this postseason, including last night. But when I look at this team, I can't remember a more opportunistic offense throughout the postseason. You could maybe put the Giants in that mold, but they really did it from their incredible starting pitching. But when I look at what the Indians have done, I didn't see as much of the Red Sox series, but in watching the Toronto series and watching Game 1 last night, it was basically the first inning against Lester was almost a microcosm of what they've been able to do all postseason long with the two-out single, the stolen base, the walks, the infield hit, the hit by pitch, manufacturing runs in that way. That's how they've been successful, and they did it again against the Cubs last night.
Yeah, they're not scoring a lot of runs. You know, last night they scored six, but three of those came in the eighth inning. You know, they're not really scoring a lot of runs, but what they're doing is they're not giving up any runs. You know, they have four shutouts so far in the postseason, and that's unbelievable when you've played only 10 games in the postseason. Wow. Or nine, I should say. I'm sorry, nine. They are pitching, and, you know, I talked to Jake Arrieta last night after the game, and he said, I don't care what anybody says, good pitching will beat good hitting every day of the week. And I know it's an old cliche, you hear it all the time, but boy, is it more true right now for Cleveland than it has been. And offensively, they just have to scratch out a couple of runs, and that's all they've needed, really, because the pitching has been so spectacular for them. I mean, think about that. Four shutouts in nine games, and you're in the postseason playing against the best teams in baseball.
Well, speaking of pitching, have you ever seen in a postseason a manager so masterfully manage the pitching staff as Terry Francona has with this Cleveland Indians team?
Well, what he's doing is he's managing in desperation. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in the sense that it's the postseason. You've got to win four games before the other team wins four in a seven-game series. And you've got to win three before the other one wins three in a five-game series. So, and that's what he did against Boston, win three in a row. You know, swept them, and then he wins four out of five against Toronto. But it's all about, hey, if we need Andrew Miller in the fifth inning or the fourth inning, let's go. Let's bring him in. And don't forget, one of the games against Toronto, the closer, Cody Allen, came in the seventh inning, and then Miller closed out the game. He's managing as though tonight is the only game that matters on the schedule, and we'll worry about tomorrow. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I talked to Cody Allen last night after the game, and he said, if Andrew Miller's coming in the fifth inning, how can anybody else on this staff say, oh, no, my role is to come in whatever inning? You do whatever is asked of you right now because the results are coming in, number one, and because it's the most important time of the year. And everybody's buying into it, and Francona is managing in sheer desperation, and I do not mean that in a negative way. I mean that in a very positive way.
Pedro Gomez joining us from Cleveland, our ESPN baseball insider. He's done it all season long here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen. Let's talk a little Kyle Schwarber, who comes in last night And in his first at-bat, he strikes out on a swing that was early on a 93-mile-an-hour fastball, which I thought was kind of funny. And then he comes back up and almost hits it out the park. A lot of eyes are on him in this DH role. Do you like the move that Madden has put in place with him being in the lineup to add protection for Bryant and Rizzo? Or is this a move that's maybe a little too risky for a guy that likes to make risks?
Not really, because when you think about it, the other big power lefty bat that they have is Jason Hayward. And Jason Hayward is not getting it done at all. So you've got Anthony Rizzo, your big lefty bat, and you need another lefty bat in there to even things out, because there's a lot of right-handed hitters in the Cubs lineup. There's some switch hitters, you know, Fowler and Zobris, but you've got a lot of righty hitters. And I absolutely, it's a great move, because Schwarber showed last season in 9 postseason games, when he hit 5 home runs, by the way, that he's not afraid of the big spotlight and the big stage, and that's what October is. And last night you saw it. Yeah, he did not look good that first at-bat. They jammed him inside, and he swung at pitches he probably shouldn't have. Don't forget, this guy's only had 2 games worth of at-bats in 6.5 months. And he showed in that second at-bat, there's the timing, he can catch up to a fastball. He may be having some trouble with the off-speed stuff, and I would expect him to see a lot of off-speed tonight. But if you do make a mistake and throw him a fastball, he's going to drill the ball. And that ball only missed out by inches of going out of the ballpark. So, I know it's a move where you're scratching your head going, this guy hasn't played since April 7th. But you kind of have to balance your lineup out. And, you know, with Jason Hayward not doing anything offensively, why not?
How important is tonight for the Cubs if they hope to actually pull out a win in this series?
I don't think it's the absolute end if they lose, because they're going back to Chicago for 3, or potentially 3. At some point they have to start getting wins. You've got Jake Arrieta against Bauer tonight, and the Cubs absolutely like their chances. And Arrieta is just chomping to get back out there, because he feels like he let down the entire team in Game 3 at Dodger Stadium when he lost to Rich Hill and all of a sudden put the Cubs in a 2-1 hole before the Cubs stormed back, winning 3 in a row. But he did not like putting his own club in that hole. And he is absolutely looking forward to getting out there. But again, it's not the end of the world if they lose, but because they are going back to Wrigley no matter what, they'd like to get on the board. But it's not, if they lose, it's by no means is the series over.
Pedro Gomez, ESPN Baseball Insider, joining us here. Let's switch gears to localize all this around the Diamondbacks. They've made some moves in the front office, and now the last major check to be checked off, I guess you could say, is the manager. I'm wondering, any news that you're hearing while you're around the World Series? Anything new starting to develop in terms of the managerial pursuit for the Diamondbacks?
Yeah, I mean, some of the things I'm hearing is that Torey Lovullo is probably the odds-on favorite to get the job. The issue is that you may be having the front office, the current, Derek Hall, Ken Kendrick dynamic, pushing hard for Phil Nevin. And this is going to be interesting, is what I'm hearing, because if Nevin gets the job, that means Mike Hazen did not get to make his own pick. And if Hazen does get to make his own pick, expect it to be someone like Torey Lovullo. And this is a front office that does not have a great reputation throughout baseball of staying out of the baseball decisions. So this is going to be an interesting hire, and I think that all of baseball will know who's really in charge by who is hired. If it's Phil Nevin, then it's the status quo. It's Derek Hall again. And if it's somebody other than Phil Nevin, then Mike Hazen truly has the reins of the baseball front office and is able to make his own decisions.
And if with Phil Nevin in particular, you mentioned it would be the Derek Hall side of things. Do you find that could be a I know the from an outside perspective, it might look like it's the same old Diamondbacks, but is this a guy that could be a good candidate for this team going forward, or do you think it would be too much around the all the other stuff?
No, there's no doubt that Phil Nevin would be a good candidate. It's not about that so much as it is about, is the GM really in charge of all baseball decisions, or is he merely there and just kind of has his say on some things but not on all things? And what we've seen over the last 12, 13 years is that the GM doesn't truly have final say on a lot of things. And that's been an issue. And that's why maybe over the last 13 years, you've seen only 3 winning seasons out of the Diamondbacks with 10 losing seasons. So, at some point, if you're hiring a GM, you've got to let the GM be the GM and make all the baseball decisions.
On the flip side of that, though, as a new general manager coming in, kind of knowing the history, don't you kind of have to expect that might happen to you as it has with other people, including guys who have had far more experience than you?
Well, again, I'll point to the fact that there's been only 3 winning seasons in 13 under this ownership regime. And one of those, by the way, was 82-80. So it was just barely over 500.
Yeah.
It's not working. So if in fact that is what happens, then I'm not sure that anything is going to really change.
Yeah. Pedro, you're very familiar with the local landscape here, and this, it looks like if Hazen does have a lot of his guys that he brings in and he's got free reign, it's going to be a lot of Red Sox guys, which isn't a horrible thing because the Red Sox have had a lot of success. But when you look at local teams here trying to emulate other organizations that have had success, like the Suns have tried to do with the Spurs and the Cardinals did a little bit with the Steelers, is that the right way to go about it? Or is it kind of bringing in more of an eclectic group of personalities a little bit better of a way to go?
Well, that's not unusual. When Dayton Moore got the Royals job, he brought in, he came from Atlanta, and he brought in some guys from Atlanta. That was a proven winning formula they had in Atlanta, and it's taken a little time, but it happened in Kansas City as well. So it's not that unusual. I'll even go back 20 years when Walt Jocketty went from the Oakland A's to the St. Louis Cardinals. And all of a sudden, Tony La Russa, Dave Duncan. There was a lot of Oakland influence that went to St. Louis, but there was a winning formula there, and there's been a winning formula in Boston. So if Hazen does bring in Boston guys, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's people that he's comfortable with. It's a proven winning formula, so that would not be the worst thing in the world. Again, I'll just point to the fact that you hire people, let them do their job.
Pedro, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it as always, and we'll look forward to catching you next week around the end of the World Series.
Okay, fellas.
That's Pedro Gomez, ESPN Baseball Insider, joining us here on the Brad Sesmat Show. That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen. Interesting little nugget there on the managerial situation. Kind of already a little bit of a power struggle, what it could sound like.
Yeah, well, welcome to Phoenix and Arizona sports. That's what we have dealt with for the last decade here in terms of most of our teams. The Suns, who we'll talk about in the next segment and for the rest of the show, have dealt with that when it comes to Robert Sarver and Lon Babby and everybody. There has always been a power struggle, it seems, consistent throughout this city.
He mentioned it. More Suns talk as they have their home opener coming up next here on the Brad Sesmat Show. It's the Brad Sesmat Show with Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen. Thanks for Pedro Gomez joining us here on the show. Yeah. What we were talking about and expanding on. So,
do you want me to just take this?
Yes.
All right.
Please do.
Let's talk a little Suns here.
Okay.
Right? We'll let Jared compose himself a little bit. Yeah, let's talk about the Phoenix Suns. A lot going on opening night tonight. Looking forward to seeing what this Suns team can do. And one of the big question marks for me has to be a lot of these teenagers that are on this roster, in particular for me, Marquese Chriss. And I don't know how to feel about this guy, because going in, I expected him to be the raw talent out of him and Dragan Bender. I thought that he was going to be the one that was a little less prepared for the season than Dragan Bender was going to be. Having played as a professional overseas, as Dragan Bender did, and Marquise Chris having so many question marks playing at Washington and how he was going to do. After preseason now, this guy looks like everybody seems to expect him to be the star in terms of this rookie class, the guy that's going to come out and play major minutes this year. I don't know how to feel about it because I still haven't fully bought in on Marquise Chris, and I haven't fully abandoned the Dragan Bender boat like a lot of people have, that where they're saying, well, maybe it'll take him 2 or 3 years. Maybe he's that foreign guy that turns into a bust. You're hearing all sorts of things just based on preseason games on both sides of the spectrum for both these guys. I don't know where I land in terms of them right now. How are you feeling in terms of Marquise Chris and Dragan Bender?
Well, I don't feel like you need to be on either side of it yet because they haven't played in actual games. They haven't been part of an actual NBA rotation and they haven't participated in an 82-game season. So I don't think there needs to be any sort of meeting some sort of one side or the other. They're at the point right now where they just, as you've mentioned many times, they need to just get minutes. And the veterans on this team shouldn't play as much significant minutes throughout the entire season. They can start like Jared Dudley is and Tyson Chandler is slated to right now, but they shouldn't be playing crazy minutes each and every night. And if they're in a position to win a game in the fourth quarter and you want to roll with the veterans down the stretch, I'm all for that. Because it is about winning games at the end of the day. But in the meat,
is it really, though, this season?
They're going to tell you that. They're going to tell you. I mean, honestly, Espo, look at it this way. This season, I've already talked about this. This season, to me, feels more like we have our draft picks. It's no longer thinking about who the next great player in the draft is because we have some pretty great young core pieces. If they can compete for a seventh or eighth seed with the young core that they have, you'd shy away from that because I'm of the opinion that if you get playoff reps already for some of these guys, even if it could help Marquise Chris or Dragan Bender, I'm not saying the Suns are going to make the playoffs, by the way, but if you have the opportunity to win games down the stretch to try to get yourself into the playoffs and get these young guys a taste of what the playoffs are this young, I'm all for that.
I don't try to shy away from making the playoffs, even if it's a 7 or 8 seed. What I try to shy away from is giving the meaningful minutes to veterans that aren't going to have any impact 2 or 3 years down the road on this team. Yeah. I'd much rather put Dragan Bender, Marquise Chris, Devin Booker, even maybe a Tyler Ulis, depending on how he's playing in a game, in a position to actually be in there in crunch time and learn what it takes to win an NBA game down the stretch against top competition.
And there
that's going to benefit them much longer and much better in the long run than playing Jared Dudley or Tyson Chandler meaningful minutes.
And I agree. I'm just saying that there will be nights. Everyone knows this over the course of an NBA season. There are nights when Jared Dudley is going to hit 6 three-pointers through 3 quarters and they're just going to have to run with the hot hand. There's going to be nights when Tyson Chandler is putting up his random 20 rebound performances and you need him in there down the stretch. There's going to be nights when Leandro Barbosa is having a great game off the bench and you roll with him. That happens with every team over the course of the season. There's going to be nights where Marquise Chris is going off and he's going to be playing way more minutes than his average is going to indicate. I'm just saying when it comes to winning games, there should be games and probably will be games down the stretch where the veterans will play because they have the hot hand. I think Earl Watson will do that because at the end of the day, it's about winning games. It's about trying to advance your franchise, and it's about getting that winning mentality back. Now, it shouldn't come at the expense of never playing these guys, the young guys down the stretch. I totally agree with you there. It's more about on a given night that it could happen.
Well, you bring up that we shouldn't be making judgment calls on either Chris or Bender right now, which I wholeheartedly agree with. But I think one of the problems we're going to see with these two guys as their development progresses is the perception. The fact that both of these guys were drafted in the lottery and it's always going to be comparing the two against each other, which I don't think is going to be fair to either of them, especially in this first season. And we've seen it through preseason. I mean, I've heard analysts even talk about, former players talk about the fact that maybe Dragon Bender is a bust. How can we already make some kind of judgment call on either of these guys when we've been through, what, six preseason games? Mm-hmm. We're talking about...
In summer league.
You know, hardly anything that they've already been through, and we're making judgment calls on these kids, and I don't quite understand it. 24 quarters of preseason basketball isn't going to be a determination on anybody's career. Marquise Chris has looked much better than we expected. He hasn't had the mental lapses that apparently plagued him at Washington. There weren't the issues with his motor and his motivation and his rebounding that we saw. But that's six preseason games, not an 82-game season. We're going to see the Marquise Chris that we expected to see at times this season. And we're going to see the Dragan Bender that can spread the floor and run the floor and do things that we saw him do in foreign leagues in the NBA this year. It's bound to happen. I'm not comfortable with everybody automatically assuming that Marquise Chris is a rookie of the year potential kind of guy, and Dragan Bender's a guy you're just going to bury on the bench until he's figured out how to play in the NBA.
Just because they happen to play on the same roster.
You've got to give them both minutes this year, because it's about learning and figuring out what you do have in those guys and figuring out how you can help them grow this year. Is winning nice? Yes. But I think it's going to be more of an accident than an actual byproduct of this season, because the only way you're going to win is as long as these young guys are playing well. If they don't play well, you're not going to win with a core of PJ Tucker, Jared Dudley, Tyson Chandler, and you know, with Eric Bledsoe and Brandon Knight. That core is not going to win without these young guys really performing.
Let's switch gears and kind of switch the tone of this segment for now. Let's get a little more. What we do here is we like to find, we have the Nicolas Cage spectrum that we've created that for the Cardinals games, for football. Let's create another kind of fictional spectrum to kind of rate the Suns on. And I'm wondering, what side of the fence are you on with these three questions? The first one, is Earl Watson going to be more Coach John Bailey, who was played by Dennis Farina in the movie Eddie? This is the coach that Whoopi Goldberg took over for, that the fans booted out and had Whoopi Goldberg come out of the stands and coach for. Is Watson going to be more of that, or Coach Carter, Samuel L. Jackson from the movie Coach Carter, with the very grand and team-oriented dynamics and coming together as a unit that Earl Watson has looked like?
Neither.
Oh.
Oh. You did mention the coach he's going to be more like. He's going to be more like Eddie. He's going to be more like Whoopi Goldberg's character in that movie, where he does things his own way. He's going to throw out all the conventional wisdom that we've seen over the last handful of years, and he's going to try to do things in a way that makes sense to him. He's talked about his lineage and working with John Wooden and the mentality that he's bringing in. This is going to be a very collegiate mentality, which you usually don't see in the NBA. And that's the way he's going to play this out with this young roster. Will it work? I don't know, because these veterans, I don't know if that rah-rah is going to play well with them. I don't know with the young guys if at some point they're going to tune it out. But that's the way he's going to go about it. He's going to be more Eddie than he is going to be Dennis Farina's character from that movie, or Samuel L. Jackson in Coach Carter.
I think he's going to be more like Coach Carter for obvious reasons. The philosophical aspect, the sticking to a plan. I think he's going to be the epitome of a coach that has a plan, and stubbornly enough, he's going to stick to it and hope at the end of the day it ends in results. That's what happened for Coach Carter, and I think Watson's going to have a similar dynamic there. Next question. TJ Warren, we've talked about him constantly, about how he's been really under the radar this season. So is he going to surprise people like Woody Harrelson would hustle people in White Men Can't Jump? Or is he going to stay somewhat unnoticed, especially from a national perspective?
He's going to be totally like Woody Harrelson in White Man Can't Jump, minus the short shorts, the weird tank top, and the fluorescent hat turned backwards. What he's going to do is he's totally going to hustle people, because nobody has talked anything about TJ Warren this year. He has been the invisible man when it comes to young guys on the Suns roster. He will come out and he will completely surprise and completely hustle everybody in the NBA, and Suns fans for that matter, who have not expected much from him.
And I think this is going to be a big year for him as well. Last one for you is, will Marquise Chris, who we've talked about a lot here on this show, will he be more Scott Howard or Teen Wolf this year?
Both. He will be both. As I brought up, you will see the guy that is unmotivated, timid, doesn't play great. The Scott Howard version, if you remember Michael J. Fox, human character in Teen Wolf. We're not talking the new MTV show. We're talking the classic movie.
Oh, of course. We know that about you.
We'll see him as Teen Wolf, the guy that can jump out of the gym, do things that are mind-boggling, and really just shock everybody. And heck, he may even surf on top of a van this year. I don't know at times. He will be an impressive specimen at times, but he also will look like a teenager at other times.
One more quick before we get out of here. We haven't talked to Alex Len. Alex Len, your overall thoughts on where we expect from him, because like Eric Bledsoe, like Devin Booker, there's a lot of pressure on those guys as it seems like this is kind of the year where we need to really see something from them. Alex Len, I think, also is in that mold.
Look, you didn't give me a movie, but I'm going to go back to one we already
talked
about.
Please do.
I'm going to go back to Eddie. You remember Yvonne in that movie?
Yvonne Make Basket.
That has been Alex Len's mentality. He's going to shoot until the ball goes in, and he needs to break himself of that mentality, because I don't need Alex Len to shoot all the time.
You need him to take a charge to win games, right?
Take a charge, get me rebounds, be a defensive force. We need to see that from Alex Len this year. I am almost off the Alex Len bandwagon and ready for the Suns to look for a better solution at center for the future. If he does not perform in the first half of the season, I would like to see them pursue some kind of young guy, use some of their assets, and Nerlens Noel, that type, and try to get in a different young center to help build around in this with this team.
That's Greg Esposito. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad on the Brad Sesmatch Show today. Coming up next, AZ Central Sports Suns beat writer Paul Coro to round out our little Suns preview here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. It's the Brad Sesmatch Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. I'm Jared Cohen. That's Greg Esposito filling in for Brad today. You can also check us out on the Dry Heat Check podcast. It's Sun season. We're excited now to talk to Paul Coro, the Suns beat writer for AZ Central Sports. And Paul, to get things started, you've already started the grind with preseason and training camp, but this is the official start to the grind of the season. So how are you feeling? You already in midseason form?
I don't know about me, but I'm ready for games that count. It's been too long covering a lot of summer league and pretend and practices, and now it's time for the real thing. I always like opening night, because especially for a team that hasn't been in playoffs since 2010, I'm not sure there's a buzz that matches opening night.
Let's not lie, Paul. Your suits are in midseason form at least, right?
I don't know. Same old, bro.
Well, before we get into kind of previewing the season, I want to take a step back and take a look at something that happened earlier in this week. Archie Goodwin was released. It came as a bit of a surprise to me and others. What was your take on why it went down and just kind of the reasoning behind it?
I thought it was a possibility going into camp, but then the more Archie played and the more John Jenkins didn't, it started to kind of fade in my mind, honestly. But I think just because, here he is 3 years later, he's still young at 22, but the progression that you'd want to see over 3 years hadn't really happened yet. He's got that great quality to get to the rim. It's an NBA quality. But beyond that, he's an off guard who doesn't shoot it that well. He just all around sort of impressions to make upon the team during preseason and training camp weren't there. They had already talked to him in the offseason about not wanting to be there, not because he didn't like Phoenix or the Suns, but just because he wanted to play, and there's always been guards stacked against him. So you don't want another situation where somebody's unhappy at the end of the bench when they've been trying to create all this unity and chemistry. And John Jenkins is the consummate pro who's, probably worked harder in the offseason than anybody, agreed to have his guarantee date pushed back just to stay around the team. He's a good shooter, and if called up if needed, he's not a rotation guy, but if needed for a team that wants to check up 33s a game, it's pretty good to have a 40% three-point shooter there waiting.
Staying on Archie just for a second, Paul, you mentioned it, you alluded to it just briefly here. It was well documented how close he was with the Morris twins, and also the fact that he wasn't able to have sustained minutes. Do you think that the personality trait or the maybe his demeanor had a little bit more to do with it than his progression in his play?
Yeah, attitude is a huge part of this. He definitely had some influences from being close to the Morris twins. I was kind of looking for a reaction from them because Archie handled himself well on Twitter when he posted an appreciation for it. And, I just think this idea that they're doing him a favor is kind of a stretch, you know, by releasing him because there's not any space on other teams. It's going to be difficult for him to land somebody else. There's only one team that's not at the max. Now, somebody could waive a guy and add him, and we could see that. But at this point, the book's out on Archie Goodwin, and he's not a point guard, and he's an off guard who doesn't shoot it real well, and he's had 3 years to improve that. And so, as flashy as that game winner was at Utah, it came against their 16 through 20 guys of their preseason roster, basically, and the guy he torched isn't on the team anymore either.
See, I need to keep that one in my playbook as a manager when I have to let somebody go that I'm doing you a favor. This really is good for you. I got to remember that one, that line. Paul, let's look at this season. I've got to be honest, I have absolutely no idea what to expect. And this is the first time in years that I didn't at least feel like there was some kind of idea of where this team would finish. How do you feel going into the season? What should the fans' outlook be with this team?
Well, I definitely expect improvement, and that's not saying much given 23-59 last year. But but I think more than anything, there'll be a good feeling about the direction it's headed, that they've embraced youth. And I think having a 19-year-old star in Devin Booker kind of pushes the franchise to be open to doing that when you're 5-6 years away from his best basketball. So now you have a team with four teenagers on opening night. That's amazing. As far as I can tell, no team's played two teenagers in a season, more than two teenagers in one season, and they have a chance to do it with four. But it's not just the teenagers. It's young beyond that, the core. I think most of the roster is 24 or younger. So now you've got Watson in, established as a head coach, some pretty good coaching staff hires and former head coaches, Jay Triano and Tyrone Corbin. You can establish a program. You can once again emphasize defense for the 40th time in Suns history.
don't forget rebounding too. That's another emphasis.
Oh yeah. That's going to be a challenge for this team, but the power forwards they have. But so I think there will be some patience required with fans, but I think they'll also be able to enjoy it a little bit more. It's a likable team. It's a team that you can look at and say, okay, I can grow with Marquise Chris while he learns how to play basketball more. I can live with Devin Booker learning how to be a starter for 82 games because he's my favorite player. Most players or most fans would say right now. So I think there's lots of feelings like that. TJ Warren might get to have his breakout season this year after really having two half seasons so far.
It's Paul Coro from AZ Central Sports joining us here on the show with Jared Cohen and Greg Esposito. Paul, a question for you I have, and this is more of a belief I have. There's so much expectation, and Espo has said in the past, pressure on Devin Booker going into this season. I'm of the opinion, though, all that expectation and pressure should be more so on Eric Bledsoe. For the amount of years he's been here, for the injuries he's dealt with, the time that he's missed, hasn't made that all-star team yet. Is it fair to say that this is one of the more important years for Eric Bledsoe in a Suns uniform?
Yeah, it seems like we say that every year since he arrived, though. I mean,
that's true.
The injuries every other year have really put a damper on what he could be. I think everybody agrees he has all-star potential. Grasping the point guard job is one of his biggest hurdles because he's always had high turnovers. He hasn't been a big vocal leadership guy, but he's really turned the corner as far as work ethic and commitment to the program the last couple of years. And so this would be, if he stays on schedule, this would be the year he plays 82.
Yeah.
And I think more than anything that you'd really like to see him fulfill his defensive potential more than anything. He was a great off-ball and on-ball player to get steals. He Jeff Horner's like used to say he should lead the league in steals because he's powerful. He's quicker. He's lost 10 pounds. He can get over screens because he's so strong. But he's also going to be asked to be the primary ball handler now. There's no more shared ball handling. So he's going to be pushing the tempo. They want to be, you know, play at the fastest pace in the league if they can. So that's a big task for him to handle the ball handler and get up into him, get over screens and fight. That's going to take high effort. And but the indication, he's had a little bit of a rough preseason because he was coming off the knee rehab and hadn't been cleared for 5-on-5 until right before training camp. So he's still working into his shape. I don't think you'll see the true Eric Bledsoe for, you know, the first couple of weeks of the season until he gets there.
Feels like the hallmark of Ryan McDonough's tenure with the Phoenix Suns has been chemistry experiments, and it seems like this year is no different with Brandon Knight now becoming a sixth man, something last year he basically said he didn't want to do. Now he seems to be more willing to, but how do you think that will play out for the Suns this year?
Well, let's be clear. It's nothing he wants to do. He's being willing to do it because that's what his coach and his team are asking of him. So he's not fighting it. And I give Earl Watson a lot of credit for laying that out early after training camp and not letting that linger throughout the preseason as a positional battle. Ever since he took over as interim coach, he's been steadfast that he was going to lay out clear, direct roles and communication about that. So that helped. That being said, it's going to be an adjustment for him. He's never done this in his career. He's not probably crazy about the idea, but they've tried to build him up about him as much as they could. You know, Earl Watson calls him the sixth starter. He calls him the most important player on the team. He says they got to get him at least 30 minutes a game, that he's the sixth man award candidate immediately. So Brandon Knight's got some living up to all that to do, and he's going to do it in a new way. But the moment he has any struggles with it, we know what's going to be attributed to, that he's never done it before.
It's Paul Coro joining us here on the show with Jared Cohn and Greg Esposito. I'm wondering, through the time of all these games that haven't counted and practices that you mentioned, who has been someone that's been a pleasant surprise to you as you've been there every day? Someone that maybe stood out or is impressing, maybe with if it's being a young guy, a little bit quicker, or if it's an off-season acquisition, maybe a bigger role. Who's someone that kind of fits that mold going into the start of the regular season?
Well, I'd say TJ Warren's defense is a lot better. That's noticeable right away, and he's bigger. You know, he's probably 6'9 now, and he's filled out more. So that's one thing that strikes you away. He just carries himself a little bit more confidently. He's always been a quiet, timid guy for the first couple of years again, and he's no chatterbox, but he's definitely coming out of his shell and looking more and sounding more comfortable. But I think the biggest surprise has been Marquise Chris. You know, even the Suns would have to admit that, given that they took Bender at 4 and Chris at 8. Chris looks far more ready to contribute right away. He gets an Amari Stoudemire comparison a lot for the things he can do on the court, as far as athleticism, the dunks, the size, the shooting. But to me, the quality he has that Amari had is fearlessness, and that's a really special NBA quality to just be so confident on the court and not, especially as a 19-year-old. You know, he thinks he can dunk on anybody. He's, you know, got into it at Andrew Bogut and threw him on the ground like he, you know, didn't know who he was, although he clearly did. Mm-hmm. he's staring people down. He's got swagger to him. You talk, he's not going to be politically correct. He's got some honesty and personality to him. So I think he's going to be a fan favorite for the way he plays on the court. It's just amazing to me for a guy that's only played organized basketball for 5 years that he has the handles that he does, the shooting touch that he does. The other stuff's going to come along. You know, he's already a better rebounder than he was at college, and he's going to pick up some defensive things over the years. But in the meantime, athleticism can make up for a lot of things.
You brought up TJ Warren. Is it just me, or does he look more athletic even coming off of a foot injury?
He's just so slithery. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he's more athletic, but the size strikes me more than anything. But he's maybe it's the bounce that he got from just working out so much. Although he couldn't work out a lot on his lower body that whole time. He'd roll around in a scooter and go to the practice court and shoot with sitting in a scooter or something like that just to do something. I mean, the guy used to show up at midnight at the gym at NC State just to practice almost every night. He's a total gym rat, so taking basketball away from him for a foot fracture just killed him. And so he's hungry to get back. He's got a starting opportunity because of P.J. Tucker's back surgery, and ideally I think they would like him to hold on to it. You know, he's the long-term starting small forward if he lives up to what they believe he can be, and he looks like a better two-way player than the last 2 years.
Paul, thank you so much for your time. We'll see you down there at downtown Phoenix, and have a great season.
All right. Thanks for having me on, guys.
That's Paul Coro, AZ Central Sports, joining Jared Cohen and Greg Esposito here on the Brad Sesmatt Show on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports.